Argument is in Appeal 1085, Innovative Therapies versus Kinetic. Mr. Graves, good morning to you. Welcome to the court.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors.
Please proceed.
May it please the court, Jonathan Graves for the appellant, Innovative Therapies, Inc. Now, as the Supreme Court noted in its MedImmune decision, the courts do not require that a plaintiff, quote, bet the farm by risking behavior that could be deemed to be unlawful or actionable.
Can I just do a housekeeping question before we get into that, and that is, what is the current status? I mean, there are two other legal actions pending, right? One in North Carolina and one in Texas. What is the status of those? Have they been stayed or are they proceeding?
The federal court patent infringement action in the Middle District of North Carolina has been stayed while the proceedings were going on in Delaware and now before this court regarding subject matter jurisdiction, as well as in light of pending reexaminations of KCI patents that are in suit. The state court case in Texas, which does not include patent infringement validity issues per se, is going on. There's currently an appeal to the Intermediate Appellate Court in Bexar County, San Antonio,
Texas. But the patent, so the North Carolina action is Kinetic having gone in and filed suit under the patent laws. Maybe you can just enlighten me. I mean, I guess I see an incredible irony in this case, in that you presumably, your argument for having rushed in for a DJ was that you needed some certainty and your client needed some certainty because they wanted to go on the market with their product. And it seems to me that the process here, and there are a lot of ironies, I guess, in the law, but the process here and the way you've chosen to proceed means that has delayed this process for years and years and years. I mean, now you've got, I mean, if you had dropped this, the North Carolina case would be proceeding. Presumably your client would have all of the uncertainties resolved. And that's, I mean, do you see the irony that I see in how this case has proceeded?
I do, Your Honor. My client did want to proceed in a form convenient to it. The Delaware form is very convenient for ITI, which is a very small startup.
And that so outweighed the interest that you had underlying, presumably, the DJ, which is you need some certainty for your client. So the convenience outweighed the certainty?
The convenience was quite important to my client, and they exercised their right to bring an action in a form of their choosing where three of the four parties are located. Also, KCI has brought into the North Carolina action Wake Forest University, which is the assignee of four of the five patents that are at issue in the Delaware case, presumably to create a nexus to North Carolina. But Wake Forest has been absent from several patent infringement cases brought by KCI in the past. They also included in that North Carolina case three foreign KCI entities that, to our knowledge, have no connection to these patents. So we would prefer to proceed in Delaware with the real parties in interest, KCI and its two subsidiaries, who have the exclusive license under these patents and the exclusive rights to enforce them without Wake Forest and without these extraneous parties. But that is an irony I have noted here, Your Honor. Now, in terms of the district court's decision to dismiss the action, the court did not conclude that there was no actual case or controversy under the all circumstances test. Rather, the court decided in the exercise of its discretion to dismiss the case. And
is that right? I mean, I was a little unclear on that. I mean, it seemed to me, arguably, there were alternative holdings here. One being there's no case in controversy, throwing out the DJ. In the alternative, in case there is or there were, I'd still apply my discretion. You read it differently than that?
I do. I don't think a fair reading of the opinion yields the conclusion that Judge Robinson concluded that there was no actual case or controversy. She seemed a little bit on the fence about that, quite frankly.
But it's really the discretionary hurdle that you have to overcome whether there is or isn't a case or controversy.
That's correct.
Is that right? And then that's what the trial judge said, that whether or not there is or isn't, I exercise my discretion because of her disaffection with the way she saw the proceedings having arisen. How do you overcome that discretionary aspect?
It's important to note when the facts, and under the metamune test, of course, it's all the circumstances, where all the circumstances do establish a substantial controversy between the parties, then it's rarely appropriate for the district court to exercise its discretion and decline to hear the case. And this court's jurisprudence makes clear that when it does so, the court must clearly articulate its basis. There must be a sound basis for the exercise of the discretion. Here, in the court's four-page opinion...
And why is there no sound basis?
Here, there's very little information whatsoever in the court's opinion regarding the basis for her exercise of discretion. She makes passing reference to the pre-suit phone calls between Mr. Toomey of ITI and two executives of KCI. And specifically, she says that ITI was not willing to make its concerns a matter of public record. And she also references the Latin phrase sub rosa, which I had to look up, and that means secret or confidential. And that's really a puzzling conclusion on the district court's part, because there was nothing secret or confidential whatsoever about the pre-suit communications between Mr. Toomey and his former colleagues at KCI. Rather, Mr. Toomey called, he said who he was, he identified to these recipients of the calls that his new company was about to launch a negative pressure wound therapy device that would have a foam dressing. He stated the purpose for his call was to determine whether there could be any business resolution between the companies, whether they could peacefully coexist, and to assess the risk of litigation to this nascent entry into a market dominated by KCI. So the court's reference to off the record or confidential really does not square with
the evidence.
Yeah, but
that wasn't necessarily the only underpinning. It wasn't because they were secret. It was because they were insufficient to establish knowledge, because it wasn't they weren't part of the litigation department. These were personal contacts, and these folks had no authority to speak or to act on behalf of Kinetic, given their positions in the company. And that was really at least one of the bases for the district court doing what she did, right? She found that those contacts were not sufficient.
But that goes to the question of whether the facts demonstrated an actual case or controversy, not whether the DJ plaintiff did something that was tactical and underhanded to give rise to a discretionary dismissal. Now, this court, to our knowledge, has affirmed a discretionary dismissal under the Declaratory Judgment Act in two cases, which are cited in the briefs. The EMC case, there the declaratory judgment plaintiff, during licensing negotiations, filed suit in a form of its choosing, contacted the patentee the next day and said, don't worry, this was just to preserve our rights. We want to keep talking license agreement. And this court found that there, the filing of the action itself was a tactical maneuver designed to gain leverage in licensing negotiations. So it would not be proper to go forward with that action in federal court. Here, there's no such evidence that the filing of the action itself was tactical. And Your Honor's question regarding Judge Robinson's comments on whether these gentlemen who received the calls had authority to speak on behalf of the company really doesn't go to the issue of discretionary dismissal. I think the court conflated that, the issue there of discretionary dismissal, with whether there was a case or controversy.
Why shouldn't she be able to consider the circumstances of the phone call as a part of the discretionary judgment, as well as considering those facts with respect to whether there was jurisdiction?
Well, I think that the court's suggestion that these gentlemen could not speak on behalf of KCI really doesn't support a discretionary dismissal.
Why not? If her sense was this was a highly artificial, contrived maneuver to take advantage of a personal relationship between two former co-workers, I mean, to make a telephone call to a guy who's about to retire and talk about his retirement and then say, oh, by the way, are you guys going to sue us? It doesn't seem like the normal way that businessmen resolve licensing issues. Nothing in writing, they're not talking to the general counsel, they're not talking to the CEO, they're talking to the marketing director and another guy who's retiring in 2 weeks. So it seemed to me she might have been quite offended by the artificiality of that, and if she were, it seemed to me she'd be entirely entitled to take that into account in weighing the discretionary factors. But you say, oh no, it only goes to jurisdiction, cannot be considered on the discretionary issues.
I misunderstood your question, Your Honor. I thought you were focused on the position of these gentlemen or whether they could speak on behalf of the company.
No, I'm talking about all the circumstances.
But in terms of all the circumstances about these phone calls, while KCI's brief uses words like artifice, deception,
I don't care about their brief. I'm talking about what the undisputed circumstances of the two telephone calls.
Here's what's undisputed. Mr. Toomey identified himself. He identified that his new company was coming out with this particular type of product, a product that cited as a predicate device in its FDA submission two other products sold by competitors that were currently being accused of patent infringement by this very patentee. He didn't engage in any sort of deception, didn't misrepresent himself, and he told these gentlemen, I'm calling to see if we can peacefully coexist, or, you know, in other words, or alternatively, to assess the risk of litigation here. And the answer that came back from Mr. Burke was neither reflexive nor obligatory. This was a gentleman who was on the 10-person executive committee and who, it turns out, as we learned from documents produced after the magistrate judge's report,
look,
was in the loop.
All that is true. I don't want to quibble with you about some of the facts versus all the other facts. Opposing counsel is going to stand up and give the other side of the story of these two phone calls. Now, it seemed to me that Judge Robinson, who I earlier confused with Judge Arterton, is entitled to weigh all the circumstances based on the evidence before her. But I understood you moments ago to be saying, no, she cannot consider that on the discretionary decision.
No, and as I said, if I conveyed that, I misspoke. I was addressing just the narrow issue of the apparent authority.
If she was considering the circumstances of the two phone calls on the discretionary issue, then what is reversible in her discretionary call?
Well, her opinion does not say that there was artifice or deception or subterfuge, but if that's what she meant, that's not supported by the record evidence. As I noted, Mr. Toomey was entirely truthful. He did not misrepresent himself, and these were not reflexive statements by lower-level employees who don't know anything about the way KCI enforces its patents. Mr. Burke was on the executive committee. He was very well aware of the way this company enforces patents, and there was nothing equivocal about his statement. He said, if you launch negative pressure wound therapy plus foam, the odds are 100% that KCI will sue you. There's no way to coexist.
Again, you're telling us a very one-sided story. He then added, if it infringes. Of course, if it doesn't infringe, we won't sue you. So, you know, if you only want to talk about the facts that are on one side of the scale, you're basically saying that Judge Robinson had to ignore all the facts that go against you and is only allowed to rely on the facts in your favor. Well, that's ridiculous. Of course she has to look at all facts that point in both directions.
I absolutely agree, but Mr. Burke did not add if it infringes. That's what KCI asserts in his brief, but a closer inspection of the declarations does not support that whatsoever. Mr. Toomey's declaration and contemporary notes show that the statement was not contingent in that regard at all, and it was, if you launch negative pressure and foam, odds are 100% you will be sued. Steer clear of negative pressure and foam. Mr. Burke did not add the caveat, well, if it infringes. This is fully consistent.
Well, I'll have to reread them both. But my recollection of all three people's memorization of the two telephone calls is that both KCI people qualified what they said that if it infringes.
Mr. Girard did. Mr. Burke did not. I would like to reserve some of my time for rebuttal. If there are no further questions, I'll yield the floor.
All right. We'll hear from counsel for
Kinetic Concepts, Your Honor.
Yep.
May it please the court, I'm Eric Pucknies, representing Kinetic Concepts. I want to start with your question, Judge Prost, about whether Judge Robinson actually dismissed under both grounds or just her discretion. What she did was she adopted the report and recommendation of Magistrate Judge Stark, which is almost entirely devoted to the constitutional issue.
Right, but she didn't really, I think she distanced herself.
The opening sentence? She says, having reviewed.
Yeah.
She doesn't say, I adopted, she says, I read it.
Your Honor, she does say adopted.
Where?
At A1, the report and recommendation is adopted and the case dismissed. It is ordered.
Yeah, but the problem is that's somewhat inconsistent, and I'm not sure you all want to go there, given that she seems to acknowledge on page 4 that the standard applied by the magistrate judge was arguably, at least, inconsistent with MedImmune. And she even kind of references that. She said in footnote 4, the broad standard established by the Supreme Court should not be anchored in such a narrow paradigm.
I understand, but I think what she was doing there, when you look at Judge Stark's report, he recognizes that the SanDisk court said generally jurisdiction will not arise without an affirmative act. And then he goes on and says, this is not the case that provides the exception to the general rule. And then he spends a lot of time on the affirmative act requirement. And I think what she's doing there, because their objection to the report and recommendation made it seem like Judge Stark was saying it's an absolute rule. It's a concrete, unwaivable rule. And what she's doing there is making it clear that both she and Judge Stark recognize that it's a general rule, but that the exception is not this case.
Well, going back to your initial point,
sure.
I guess my precise question was, do you read her opinion as having decided no case in controversy in the alternative, even if there were, I'm exercising my discretion?
That's exactly how we review it. And it makes sense if you consider Judge Stark's position as a magistrate judge, where he ends his report with a policy issue, but perhaps doesn't feel comfortable going into the realm of the district court judge on the discretionary aspect. So he lays out the law. He lays out the legal foundations for why it should be dismissed, provides a policy reason for why that's the right decision anyway, and then she takes it from there and says, okay, I agree with the magistrate judge on the law. Now me as the district court judge, because this is my province, I'm going to now consider the discretionary aspect. And so that's why her opinion focuses more on the discretionary aspect, because that's her part of the equation.
So how do you then reconcile her closing where she says, even if there's jurisdiction?
Oh, I think it's an alternative holding, which
she
is
says in the beginning where she says, I adopt the magistrate's ruling.
Well, because I think she's saying, look, even if there were jurisdiction in this situation, and I don't, but even if there were, I would exercise my discretion and dismiss the case that way. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the discretionary aspect of her decision, and starting with the Supreme Court's statement in Wilton, which is, when we're looking at the district court's decision to dismiss in its discretion, that the district court should get, and the language here is unique and substantial discretion in the declaratory judgment context, especially for decisions and considerations of wise judicial administration. Now, Judge Robinson is the former chief judge of perhaps the most active patent court in the nation. There is no judge that understands
yeah,
more.
Yeah, but we don't rate judges.
No, I understand,
for
Your Honor.
But to apply the abuse of discretion.
Exactly. But from her standpoint, the wise judicial administration is at the forefront of her mind as a former chief judge. And she understands the burden that patent cases in particular put on judicial resources.
But Mr. Puckney, she doesn't say a single word in her opinion about efficiency of the resolution of these issues in the one court versus the other. So you're asking us to write a new opinion for her based on what you think was in her mind that she didn't write down.
Well, Magistrate Judge Stark at A20 talks about the policy reasons behind not adopting the rule that ITI wants in this case, and that is, if there is no consequence to filing a premature declaratory judgment action, that you've taken away any incentive for potential declaratory judgment plaintiffs to hold back.
I'm trying to direct your attention to the lack of reasoning, in her opinion, regarding the exercise of discretion.
Well, she states her...
Why isn't this reversible for a lack of any analysis regarding discretionary dismissal?
Well, because I think Judge Prost's comment at the beginning of my opponent's presentation, which was the irony of a party filing a declaratory judgment action and then moving to stay before
that
wasn't,
going to I mean, I was dealing with all of the stuff that's happened since. Mm-hmm. That wasn't really, I mean, we're looking at what Judge Robinson thought,
right?
Not, you know, my post hoc rationalization for why I think in hindsight she may have been right.
Where is there any reasoning in her opinion about efficient use of either court's resources?
Well, she doesn't talk about efficient.
No,
she
says one thing as I read it, so tell me if you have any add-on. I think it comes down, her exercise of discretion comes down to one part of one sentence where she says, nevertheless, where, as here, a DJ plaintiff was not willing to make its concerns a matter of record pre-suit, I am not convinced the objections of the DJ actor being served, blah, blah, blah. So I, having read these four pages over and over again, it seems to me that's the nub. Do you agree?
I think that's
her analysis with respect to her exercise of discretion.
Yes.
So why is that sufficient?
Well, it's sufficient because, and she cites Judge Bryson's concurrence in Sandisk here, which is the purpose of the Declaratory Judgment Act is to resolve disputes. But where one party refuses to even engage the patentee before filing suit, that is not going to help resolve disputes.
Well, wait a minute. Their version is they did engage the patentee through these two phone calls.
Well,
so it has to be the logic of your argument that you've got to do it in writing or it doesn't count.
That's not correct, Your Honor. The logic of our argument is you've got to make your concerns a matter of record with people who count, with people at the patentee who can actually make these decisions. And she makes a factual finding here that neither Burke nor Gerard are the right people to talk to at KCI, and there's indisputable support in the record.
No, in the proceedings, the sentence preceding the one I read, she starts off saying put the point differently, and she does say exactly that they were not used, they were not in decision making positions.
That's correct.
They were not. So you read those two together and say that her interpretation of why they didn't make their concerns a matter of record is because they were only dealing with non-decision-making people?
That, and also that Toomey was not direct in the purpose of his phone calls. And if you look at the context of the phone calls, she's absolutely right. There's no other way to read these facts. Toomey calls Burke on the eve of his retirement, in Burke's car, on his cell phone, while Burke's on his way to Mexico. He calls him, the stated purpose of the phone call is to congratulate him on his retirement. And then he turns and asks for Burke's fatherly advice. He asks for his personal opinion. He's not asking for his, as an officer of KCI, I want to know what KCI's position is. He's asking for fatherly advice. And so Burke speaks and he gives his 100% certain comment. But then even under Toomey's declaration, Toomey says, and then he clarified, And the language is anything that scratches the surface of our patents we'll go after. And so a layman's way of putting anything that infringes KCI will go after. And that's the way Magistrate Judge interpreted that statement, and that is not a clearly erroneous interpretation by any extent.
Shouldn't the district judge have to make something in the nature of Rule 52A findings of fact as to the factual circumstances that justify declining to exercise DJ jurisdiction when there is jurisdictional facts proven, but discretion is going to be exercised?
I agree that there needs to be reasons given, but she adopted Magistrate Judge's report without qualification, without reservation, and Magistrate Judge's report is 20 pages long. It provides a detailed factual description of everything that went on and concludes with a policy reason for why ITI should not be allowed to benefit from its premature filing of this complaint in this case. And so you have to read the two together. If Judge Robinson's four-page opinion stood on its own, it would be a tougher opinion to defend. But she adopts that 20-page report, and that 20-page report is extraordinarily detailed and provides all the information this court needs to understand the situation below and what was going through the district court's mind.
So in order to establish a case in controversy, you have to contact the patentee's legal department and make them explicitly aware of your product? That's
no.
That's a necessary requirement?
We are not advocating a blanket rule here, but there needs to be a case or controversy between the parties, between the companies, and however that comes up, you can meet the jurisdictional requirements here. But in this case, if they're going to contact KCI, remember KCI was generally aware of ITI but couldn't really find out any information about it.
They did have the information.
They had some information.
And they had the FDA.
Yes, they had 510Ks. Their marketing people were looking at it. Their legal people were not looking at it.
Well, whose fault is that? Because that happened to be the case here. I mean, there's no general rule that it's only marketing and not legal people.
Oh, well, I agree, but the significance of it here is that, you know, what was going on internally at KCI is really irrelevant. What is relevant is whether there is a dispute between KCI and ITI in September 2007 when they filed the Declaratory Judgment Act. And there wasn't. There was no communication between the parties. There were no threatening acts from KCI towards ITI. We're not asking for a blanket rule out of this case that covers all of them. What we're looking at is this court's jurisprudence and saying, when you look at what this court requires for a case or controversy, it's just not there in September 2007.
What's missing specifically?
What's missing specifically is any controversy between KCI and ITI. All they have are two personal opinions of people, friends of Toomey's, former colleagues of Toomey's.
Well, they certainly are friends and former colleagues, but I don't quite understand how you can suggest that everything they said in these two phone conversations was purely on the personal side, not on the corporate side.
Well, when Burke gives his description of how he thinks the decision makers at KCI would react, he's in doing it in response to Toomey's request for fatherly advice. The conversation with Mr. Girard.
Calling it fatherly advice four times doesn't help me. The guy's on the management committee. He's a senior official of the company. He's asked about an infringement issue, and you're suggesting, well, his answer is purely personal. It's a personal conversation. It has nothing to do with the company. That just doesn't sound plausible to me.
If it were not a purely personal conversation, if Mr. Burke understood this part of the conversation, this 1 or 2 minutes of the conversation, to be a corporate discussion matter, there's nothing in the record that suggests that either Burke or Girard went to anyone else at KCI and said, oh my gosh, I just got this phone call from a potential competitor. And when you think of the way Toomey described the product as essentially a knockoff of KCI's VAC, he doesn't go to anybody. Girard doesn't go to anybody. They obviously felt, and the district court found, that they thought they were having personal conversations. They thought that what was going on between them and Toomey was a confidential...
Where is that finding?
There's the finding that it's a personal conversation.
Where is that?
It's in... Judge Robinson refers to it as a... they were not informed of the real purpose behind the conversations, and from that I infer that she's talking about...
Wait a minute. You said there was a finding.
Well,
then either it would have to be by Robinson or by Stark. So I want to see a page number and a line number where the language of either fact finder makes a finding of fact.
You're right, Your Honor. As far as a finding of fact...
You've got to be a little bit careful.
I understand.
You know, when you make an inference, you can't call it a fact finder's finding.
The way...
You can say, I infer from this and that piece of evidence. But you shouldn't be saying, the fact finder found.
If I can explain my inference, all of the briefing below, all of the briefing before the magistrate judge and the district court judge were based on KCI's representation that these were personal phone calls and based on the declarations. And so she had an option here, and I see I'm running out. I'm out of time, but she had
two stories. You're not out of time until we tell you you're out of time.
I understand. She has two interpretations of the facts in front of her. She has ITIs, which is these were professional phone calls between business people. And she has KCI's interpretation, which is Burke and Girard thought these were personal telephone calls, and Burke and Girard talk about the circumstances surrounding the phone calls. And so she resolves it, obviously, I think, in KCI's favor here. And so that's why I infer, and I apologize for stating or suggesting that it was explicit. But looking at the record, it's clear that she interpreted the facts that way.
Well, I think we've exhausted this conversation between the former colleagues, so let me turn to another point which troubles me, and that's the reference to the 510K.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you argue that other district courts may have concluded that that evidence is insufficient, but she didn't draw any conclusions about the insufficiency of that.
That's correct.
To put them on notice here. So isn't that a gap in her analysis with respect to either whether there's a case in controversy or alternatively whether or not she's going to exercise her discretion?
It's not, Your Honor, because whether there is a case or controversy depends on the dealings between the parties. What's going on behind the scenes at KCI is frankly irrelevant. We had made the point that KCI hadn't even done an internal infringement analysis, but that was more for, you know, flavor. You know, not only had we not contacted ITI about possible infringement, we hadn't even done an infringement analysis internally either. And so whether or not the 510Ks were sufficient, or whether or not there was an infringement analysis, does not say anything about whether there was a case or controversy between KCI and ITI. So there's no gap in her not dealing with the 510Ks.
Mr. Pucknies, was anything done to move the North Carolina suit forward, or was it stayed kind of in effect at day one?
Your Honor, we have been trying to lift that stay, and we fought the stay initially.
Well, that's not responsive. Was there any discovery? Were there any dispositive motions? Were there any progress in the case? Or is it just a complaint and an answer and then a dead standstill ever since?
It's essentially a complaint and answer and a dead standstill. We've taken some discovery in the Delaware case and have been doing our best to try to move discovery forward in North Carolina, but we haven't been successful. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
All right, Mr. Graves.
Your Honor, may I have rebuttal time restored?
Yes, we'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, counsel's comment that one has to read the magistrate judge's report together with Judge Robinson's opinion to understand the basis for Judge Robinson's discretionary dismissal is, I think, quite telling here, because the fact of the matter is Magistrate Judge Stark never addressed the issue of discretionary dismissal in his report. So that report cannot be used to fill the large gaps in the district court's opinion regarding a basis for discretionary dismissal, which is this.
Well, again, that goes back to your argument that certain facts can only bear on jurisdiction and cannot bear on discretion. It seems to me quite possible that that the same set of facts could bear on both issues.
I'm actually making a different point, Your Honor, which is the magistrate judge's report never finds that there was something improper regarding the pre-suit phone calls, never addresses discretionary dismissal. In fact, he says he's assuming all the facts as alleged by ITI, to be true. So his report cannot be used to fill the gaps in Judge Robinson's discretionary dismissal analysis. That's the point.
I guess I still don't understand.
Why not?
but even I don't see her analysis as being these guys were sneaky and I don't like what they did and therefore I'm exercising my discretion. I read as saying they contacted the wrong people and these people have no authority to do it. And so therefore they didn't come up, as she says, with, you know, they didn't contact, not willing to make its concerns a matter of record pre-suit. So I don't think this was kind of, we're reviewing whether or not she made this correct decision on the propriety or the niceties of who contacted it. I think it was purely made because these people didn't have the authority. And that's what your client placed his reliance on when he filed the DJ.
But we had reliance on many other facts, objectively proven facts that are not disputed here. Namely, our 510Ks identified two devices.
That came in the amended complaint, right? The 510K?
No. No, that's not correct. The amended complaint added facts about the post-filing inspection of our product by KCI and refusal to grant a covenant not to sue, and then, of course, the subsequent action in North Carolina, among other facts. But at the time we filed the initial action, we pled that we had asserted the accused devices of Medela and Blue Sky as predicate devices. Those companies were already in litigation with this patentee. This patentee had sued each of the competitors who had come out with a negative pressure plus foam device.
I guess it reveals abysmal ignorance, but it's not entirely clear to me what the legal force and effect is of the FDA phraseology predicate devices. What is that supposed to mean to us?
It means that the applicant is certifying that its device has the same technological characteristics as the predicate device.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily bear on infringement versus non-infringement. It may just bear on whether they're similar enough that since the earlier device was found to be safe and effective by FDA, that the later device would also be assumed to be safe and effective. So it's not clear to me that the phrase predicate device tells us anything about infringement versus non-infringement.
It doesn't go to the conclusion of whether there's infringement or not, but here it's a factual circumstance that's very relevant to a case or controversy because ITI already knew that both of the other competitors that came out with this device had been sued for patent infringement and were embroiled in ongoing litigation with KCI.
Well, you say this device, but it isn't this device. It's a predecessor device.
Right, but actually counsel described Mr. Toomey's characterization during the phone calls of the ITI device as a knockoff of the VAC, which is a telling statement because all Mr. Toomey said was negative pressure plus foam. Well, that's what the predicate devices had. And the notion that KCI would sue any negative pressure device plus foam was fully supported by the existing litigations and by its internal documentation showing that it believed its patent estate barred the use of negative pressure plus foam. So those are relevant factual circumstances.
Was there any live testimony here, either before the magistrate judge or the district judge?
No, there were just some depositions and the written declarations.
Can I ask, I don't want to use much, well, your time's already exhausted. You've got markings on, we've got confidential briefing in this case, and I guess what is the basis for it? It's not intuitively obvious to me why what you've marked confidential was
different. I believe the only basis for any confidentiality designation was that the documents that KCI produced to us after the magistrate's report were internal KCI documents that they marked as confidential. So the documents showing that they discussed ITI and its 510K submission at competitive intelligence meetings, and then documents reflecting their investigation of ITI were marked as confidential by the defendant.
In a recent case, if I'm recalling correctly, a panel in an opinion by Judge Rader suggested that in circumstances such as this, the discretionary analysis may look almost exactly like the 1404 transfer analysis. Do you think that that case required Judge Robinson to make a transfer type analysis as opposed to the analysis represented by her actual opinion?
Absolutely. In fact, KCI took that very position below, and we agreed that since what we were dealing here with was competing foreign interests.
Do you think it's error per se for her to not have explicitly written up a 1404 analysis?
I believe so. The Micron decision says that whereas here you have competing foreign interests, the district court must analyze the convenient factors under 1404A, and that's particularly important, Judge Rader's opinion said, in the wake of Metamine, which lowered the bar for D.J. jurisdiction.
Is must in the Micron opinion?
Must and need are both in the opinion in connection with phraseology.
What's the exact wording? Do you have that?
Yes, I can pull that.
Micron was a transfer case, right? Because Judge Robinson recognized that her decision would have an effect. She put it in a footnote. But this wasn't a transfer case. Was transfer requested?
There was an alternative request by KCI in its motion to dismiss for transfer to the second file venue.
It's not decided in this opinion, is it?
That issue is not decided here, and it should have been addressed as part of the discretionary dismissal analysis.
Give me the exact language from Micron. The language that conveys the word or the notion must, mandatory. You know, my question to you is it reversible error per se to fail to include a 1404 analysis? You said yes, it's reversible per se.
I believe so under Micron because we do have competing fora here at issue. At page, this is 518 F3rd at 904, quote, therefore, the trial court weighing jurisdiction additionally must consider the real underlying dispute, the convenience and suitability of competing forms. In sum, the trial court must weigh the factors used in a transfer analysis as for any other transfer motion.
Well, are you interpreting that quoted statement as setting up a requirement that a declaratory judgment action has to be converted into a transfer motion and analyzed as if it were nothing but a transfer motion?
No, I believe the court still needs to assess the existence of an actual case or controversy under all the circumstances. And then, if it's considering the issue of discretionary dismissal, and there is a subsequent filed action for patent infringement in another venue, then, under Micron, the court must engage in the convenience factors analysis of 1404A as part of that.
Do you make that argument in your brief?
Absolutely.
Where is that? I'm trying to...
Starting at page 37 of our opening brief, we note in the first paragraph that this court's precedent requires the district court to apply the convenience factors of a transfer analysis under 1404A, and then we go on to discuss the Micron case. And here there's no question that was not done, despite both parties urging that it must be done.
All right, I think we have the positions of both sides pretty well in hand, and we have the two opinions and the underlying depositions and so forth, so we'll just have to sort it all out. We thank both counsel. We'll take the appeal under advisement.
Thank you, Ron.